today. Good morning and welcome to Shattering Myths. I am Yada, your host. And this program, as you many of you know, is dedicated to exposing the beguiling and destructive nature of the myths associated with religion and politics, with patriotism, military, and economic schemes. Instead of merely presenting the news, our mission is to help you understand why these things are occurring, to share what you can do to protect yourself and your family, all while predicting what these things portend for our future. Then during our second hour, we're going to engage God on His terms by way of His covenant through His Torah teaching, ultimately skewering religion and replacing it with reason. Our phone number for those who would like to engage in this discussion is 877-300-7645. A couple of days ago, I shared two quotes from Benjamin Franklin. One of them is intriguing, an interesting word picture. The other is incredibly foreboding. The first of them is, democracy is like two wolves and a lamb voting on what to have for lunch. And this, which is an outgrowth of that, it says, when people find that they can vote themselves money, that will herald the end of the republic. When people find that they can vote themselves money, that will herald the end of the republic. If, as we would suspect, that the 47 million Americans who receive food stamps voted for Obama because it was a greater likelihood that they would continue to receive money from the federal government, then that represented 75% of his votes. We were talking about the U.S. economy, things like taxation, Democrats versus Republicans. We talked about whether higher taxes resulted in more or less revenue for the government, whether or not there was a correlation between lowering taxes and economic growth, raising taxes and economic constraint. And if higher taxes led to greater employment, as the president has been trumpeting, or to greater unemployment. So here's a president saying that he's the president of the middle class, so he is going to assure that taxes are raised on the most productive Americans. Historically, do we have a means of determining whether or not that is counterproductive or productive? And so what I decided to do, and we've already dedicated three programs to this, this will be the fourth, is to investigate the correlation between taxes and unemployment, between taxes and economic growth, between taxes and overall government self-restraint in terms of spending. And while I still have more research to do, and I hope to conclude all of this research with you on Monday, I still have more to report today, I think, than we'll have time to consider all of this information. As you know from our previous discussions, Republicans took control of Congress, and by when I say Republicans, you're going to hear that prior to probably the Bush presidencies, if you look at who is in control of Congress, you can pretty much track the decisions that led to a robust economy all favorable things for the country to Republicans controlling Congress, and you can pretty much track all bad things that happened to the U.S. economy and subsequent unemployment and rising deficits to Democrats controlling Congress. Now, it gets considerably murkier during the Bush years he was a wolf in sheep's clothing. But for the most part, what you're going to hear is that the history is clear. Democrats controlling Congress, bad for everything in our country. Republicans controlling Congress, considerably better. Now, that said, you need to know I am not a Republican or a Democrat. I do not vote. I do not participate in elections. I am opposed to both parties. I think that choosing between the lesser of two evils associates one with evil, and there are so many negatives associated with the Republicans, like George Bush leading America into two counterproductive wars that made bad situations worse, and him being a hypocrite, a wolf in sheep's clothing, that those negatives outweigh any positive of having a Republican administration and therefore the hope of more fiscal conservatism in government. So I don't support either party. But the facts are as they are. Republicans took control of Congress in 1919, and they produced a $7 billion surplus, a federal surplus in 1920, by reducing taxes. They initially reduced them from 77% to 73% on the most productive Americans, and ultimately down to 25%. Republicans then continually controlled all three branches of the U.S. government for the decade thereafter, and for the longest period in the nation's history, creating budget surpluses of $11 billion in 1921, then $6 billion, $4 billion, $6 billion, $4 billion, $4 billion, $7 billion, $5 billion, $4 billion, and $5 billion from 1922 to 1930. And let me underscore this. Those were not deficits. Those were year after year of surpluses, where the government spent less than it took in. And the government spent less than it took in when taxes were reduced by an enormous amount, from 77% to 25%. You know, one-third, a two-thirds reduction to one-third of the previous rate. And during that time, where taxes were radically diminished on the most productive Americans, the economy grew faster than any time in its history, and faster than any economy in world history, as a direct result of diminishing the tax rates on the most productive Americans by two-thirds. Even in 1930, there was a surplus, all while lowering the taxes, which is a historical trend that we would be foolish to ignore. In 1921, as I have stated, the tax rates fell from 77 to 73%, and then they fell to 58% in 1922 through 1923. They fell to 46% in 1924, before going all the way down to 25% from 1925 to 1931. The result was the longest and most robust time of economic growth in American history. During this time of having control of all three branches of the U.S. government, much lower taxation, therefore, resulted in building an enormously successful economy. With Republicans still in control of two of the three branches of the U.S. government, the budget was balanced between 1929 and 1930, with surpluses finally becoming a deficit of $19 billion in 1931, all with the highest federal rate at 25%. So there continues to be a direct, irrefutable, and substantial connection between decreasing taxes, turning deficits into surpluses, all while producing economic expansion. And the reason I say that is we have to realize that the sharpest depression in U.S. history was the one that took place just before Republicans came to control all three branches of the U.S. government and reduced taxes. So they took America out of a depression whose onset was far worse than the depression in 1929 and turned that enormous downturn into a robust, roaring economy with budget surpluses and economic growth. We have John on the phone from California. He wants to speak on the subject of the economy, and I think also of taxation. Go ahead, John.
Yes, Yada. I feel that your analysis is quite limited and does not take into context the way in which the United States empire has unfolded in a historical context. For example, are you familiar with the Reinhardt and Rogoff book, This Time It's Different, the Harvard professors that analyzed the economic collapses over the last 800 years?
I have not read their book. Why don't you summarize their findings?
I suggest you do so. Every empire has a life cycle. No, and
yes.
In the United States is no different there. And you will notice that this doesn't just have to do with taxation. It has to do with the life cycle of a country, the way that an economy is organized. For example, in the 1940s, after World War II, the United States had 48% of the world's GDP. Do you know what percentage it was when we left the gold standard under Nixon? It was
what
only 38%. Do you know what percentage of the world's GDP the United States is today?
Much less.
It's less than 18%. We are already collapsing, sir. And it will not make any difference who is in charge. The Democrats and the Republicans both work for the banks. It's quite
obvious. Let me stop you there, John. We are in agreement on most of what you said. There are life cycles of countries. There isn't any country that has endured since it was founded. So all countries naturally have life cycles. And there are many common threads between the rise of civilizations and the fall of civilizations. Many of those threads have nothing to do with taxation, the type of government, or even government spending. But there are also debates and discussions that are pertinent to our time, which is what we are discussing now. We're not discussing the aggregate causes of civilization to rise or to fall. But let me finish, John. I gave you a considerable amount of time. The entire purpose of this discussion was singular, to look at the U.S. deficit, its growth, and the correlation between the deficits and spending, the deficits and government revenue, the deficits and taxation, and the correlation of those things to the economy, because that was supposed to be the big issue of the last election. And so when we return from the break, John, if you can stay with us, we'll speak both to the issue of government decline and national decline, where we agree, and also the subset of that. Hello and welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yada. We have John from California on the phone, who has made a point that I don't think is completely consistent with the topic of our discussion, but a point that is nonetheless true, that nations rise and fall, and there are common threads between their rise and their fall. Our discussion was strictly on the U.S. deficit and taxation and economic growth is just simply one subset of the various things that make nations rise and fall. John, my favorite book on this regard, because we would concur, America can't be saved. America is in a death spiral that is irreversible. And for lots of reasons, the deficit in going from the Declaration of Independence to the Declaration of Dependence is a huge part of it. But my favorite books in terms of just understanding the life cycle of nations would be Will and Ariel Durant's Story of Civilization. It's probably 20 volumes, each averaging over 1,000 pages. But if you have the time to really investigate the history of the rise and fall of civilizations, it's a great primer, because it does address many of the universal themes that bring nations to their knees.
Well, if I may just say one thing, Yada, my only point was that your focus was on taxation, and that's kind of such a subset. It's kind of like when a patient is in intensive care and you want to discuss whether or not you should give them an aspirin. It's simply irrelevant. The bottom line is that the United States has already collapsed. And you can see that with the rise of the TSA and the other fascist tendencies of the country. If you took all of the money generated by every single human being in the United States and they gave all of it to the government, it still wouldn't be enough to address the debt.
All right, John, we agree on your general conclusions that you couldn't confiscate all of the money held by Americans and retire the debt, and that if we raise taxes to 100% of income, it still would not solve the problem. In fact, what I have said in many programs is that if you actually want to reduce the U.S. deficit, you have to start by immediately cutting the size of the U.S. government by 50% across the board and reduce it every year thereafter from that point. But even doing so, and I made this point countless times on this program, even if you were to get America's financial house in order by radically diminishing the size of government, making it at most 15 to 20% of its present size, even if you were to do that, even if you were to resolve the issues of taxation and create incentive again, even if you were to do that, America still cannot be saved because we have far bigger problems than just our deficit. We have far bigger problems than our declining economy. So we agree in all of that there are so many issues that have plagued and are poisoning America that this is a nation that cannot be saved. That does not change the fact that during the last year, the primary discussion between Democrats and Republicans running for office was whether or not we should raise taxes on the the highest wage earners, and whether or not that would bring down the deficit, whether or not the deficit was a spending problem or a revenue problem. And so the thought about devoting a few programs to helping people understand the correlation between taxes and deficits and taxes and government spending and economic growth seemed to be a worthwhile endeavor. Now, if you want to say that it's not worthwhile because America's already gone, then, you know, so be it. I've got no issue with you coming to the conclusion that America is essentially a quivering corpse. We aren't quite a corpse yet, but we're barely quivering.
Okay. Well, all I'm saying is that just because the two parties of the one-headed government that runs this country said that one says that they should be paying more taxes, one said that they should be paying less taxes, it's all magic tricks. It's all look at the bird, completely has nothing to do with the real situation going on.
Yeah, we would agree. We would even agree there, John. And I want to thank you for calling in for your comments. One of the things that I have said routinely is that the Democrat and Republican parties are just different sides of the same coin. They all have the same agenda, and particularly if you look at what they have done most recently, it's actually Republican administrations that have been more to blame for the mess that we are in now than the Democrats. So there is no reason to try to differentiate between the two parties. But yet, historically, as we analyze how we got into this mess, there is a clear and undeniable trend. And so all we're doing now is discussing that trend, one that becomes very murky. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. For those of you who are new to the program, just because of the last caller, who I'm glad called, because we actually agree on most things, that that America is way too far gone to save, that even if you could get America's economic house in order, the patient would still die. And while that's true, there is no aspect of America's death that is a greater contributor to its demise than is its deficit. Its tendency to move from towards a dependent nation of redistribution of wealth, and where the nation has essentially stopped being a manufacturer. Now I think that manufacturing is between 9 and 10% of gross domestic product, and in terms of being the world's economic engine, that is no longer the case. So there are lots of things that have led to that, and taxation and government spending are amongst them. So we'll continue to do that. Just as, you know, Greece rose and fell, understanding what killed it is valuable today. Rome rose and fell. Understanding what killed it is valuable today. America rose and is dying. Understanding what's killing it is especially relevant today. But beyond all of that, when we find that our politicians lie, when we find that there are clear trends and they aren't known, then we learn a lot about the ignorance of the citizens of the nation as well as the character of politicians. And doing so is valuable because Yahweh has an express interest in us walking away from our country. He does not want us to be patriotic. He does not want us to be political. He does not want us to be religious. And that understanding why those things are unreliable and undependable is very helpful in the process of encouraging people to walk against the crowd, to turn their back on that which is popular, and embrace God, who, while not popular, is reliable. So, returning back to the 1920s, it's important to remember that the growth that was caused by reducing taxation commenced amid the worst depression in American history, with 33% economic contraction and 38% unemployment that preceded this growth. It also serves as an irrefutable model on how to exit a recession and stimulate economic growth, while at the same time transitioning from enormous deficits to surpluses. There is no better microcosm than the 1920s and 1930s, particularly if you go to the late 1910s, where the deficits were large and where the economy went into depression. Look at the trend that was so robust during the 1920s when we had government surpluses and low taxations and great growth. And then what happened in the 1930s and early 40s, where the deficits rose enormously, where unemployment rose enormously, and where we had the longest period of economic downturn during a period of rapidly rising taxation. And so this is a wonderful microcosm for those striving to understand this aspect of Americans' decline. So far, the lesson here is threefold. Democrats with Republicans circa 1920, the nation replaced, I should say, Democrats with Republicans circa 1920. They lowered the tax rates on the most productive Americans by two-thirds. And if you look at what happened as a result and the depression that was remedied as a result of that, you would be inclined not to follow lying politicians. You would not follow greedy bankers. You would not pledge your allegiance to immoral generals or commit to worthless wars. There is a huge correlation between war and deficits. And we need to keep that in mind as well. And that the last caller was right when he spoke of the fact that politicians are in the pockets of international bankers and banking cartels like the Federal Reserve. Because as the Rothschilds have demonstrated and have learned, that if you can plunge nations into war, the bankers profit. And that's precisely what has happened. Nations go into debt and have to borrow money and pay interest to bankers when they fight wars. And in the case of America, virtually all of America's wars should not have been fought. They were counterproductive. In many cases, they made bad situations worse, but in most cases, there was no justification for them whatsoever. Now, I've explained twice how the Federal Reserve manipulated the money supply expressly to make loans too easily available at artificially low rates, only to constrain the money supply to force the liquidation of business investments, and how that led to what has become known as the Great Depression. And I've also shared on this program how those same conditions, say two exceptions, served to cause the most recent Great Recession that the country is still enduring. The differences were simply that the federal government, both Republican and Democratic sides of the aisle, were in cahoots with the Fed in manipulating the money supply most recently, and making mortgages for homes too easily available at too low a rate, and the people's investments were now in homes. They were mortgages, not businesses, because by this time America was no longer in the business of business. So the only two differences between the cause and result of the Great Depression and the most recent Great Recession is that the trends are all the same. Money too easily available, too low a rate, money constrained, rates go up, people have to dump their assets. The differences are the purchases previously were mostly in businesses, and most recently with the Great Recession, they were mostly in homes because America is no longer in the business of business. And second, now the government itself was in the Washington was in cahoots with the banking cartel, just as our last caller suggested, and therefore they played an enormous role in micromanaging the mortgage business such that these conditions existed. And therefore, if you're looking for a cause of the Great Recession, you can look directly to Capitol Hill. Yes, Scott?
Just listening to you talk, I actually think that I'd even go as far to say that America has become almost anti-business.
Yes.
Just because a guy says, President Obama says, you didn't build that.
Yeah, right.
The amount of taxes that are put on to businesses and stuff like that, I'd go as far as to say they're even anti-business.
You know, when you look at it, if it were not for business, there would be no America. What's little left of business is all that keeps America upright. You know, the moment you oppose business, then there is no America left. They pay all the bills. All of the wealth that is being redistributed from business. Business either pays the corporate tax, which is a small percentage of the overall income to the federal government, but it pays all of the payroll tax, either directly or indirectly, and all of the personal income tax is derived from people who are working by either buying businesses or for businesses. And so the moment we lose fact, which we have as a nation, of the fact that business is the thing that makes this country go, and now it's become a foe of most people, then you lose sight of reality, and that's what's happened. We've gone from a nation that was encouraged to be productive to a nation now that has learned that it can vote itself money and become parasites.
Well, I look at it from other governments' point of view. Why would I invest in you if you don't have anything worth investing in? And that's what your businesses are. That's what generates money and things like that.
Right.
There's nothing to invest in. They're not going to invest in another government. I mean,
yeah. You know, one of the things that surprised me, Scott, in this last election is that Obama constantly harped at Romney for Bain Capital, as opposed to America understanding, hey, we've got one guy that has bought businesses and has run businesses and has built businesses, and we have another guy who has never even worked a day in his life for a business. And rather than seeing that as the greatest divide probably in recent American history between can do and can't do, he turned that into, well, Bain Capital is terrible because it exported jobs. Well, here's the reality of that. Is that the businessman's fault for saying, you know, the conditions for making things in America are so inopportune and they're so superior in other countries that it makes economic sense to invest in other countries? When that is the case, when somebody who is looking out for the best interest of their business makes that decision, it's not their fault. It's the government's fault for creating the environment in America where it isn't productive to make things in America. That means that we've overtaxed the business in America, and we've overregulated business in America, we've overburdened business in America, so that the decision to make things elsewhere is more beneficial, and it's not practical to make things in America. The problem there isn't the businessman, as the politicians would say, because America now loves to hate business. It's government for destroying America's capacity to be productive. Moreover, if you reward failure, which is what we're doing with 50% of Americans paying no income tax and receiving checks from the government, when you reward failure and you punish success, which we do by confiscating the wealth of those who are the most productive and regulating them, what you do is you get more failure and less success. It's all really pretty simple, and the facts bear it out. Now, this from the Cato Institute. A year before the bottom of what became the Great Depression, the Revenue Act of 1932 increased the top marginal federal tax rate on personal income from 25% to 63%. They increased the corporate tax rate from 12% to 14%, and doubled the estate tax rate. That would be a tax on a tax, because that what was left over had was just the result of what had not previously, it was the result of what the person was able to retain after being taxed. So now it's a tax on a tax. The Revenue Act of 1936 further increased the top marginal income tax bracket and raised it up to 79%. And the rate on undistributed corporate profits up to 42% on corporations. That means that if a company tried to create a nest egg for to continue to meet payroll and to continue to invest in their business, that money was confiscated by the federal government. No wonder the recession continued for a decade. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yetta. We're talking about this analysis that from history that helps us understand the how we got into the mess that we're in now with our economy. And it is, of course, interesting to note that in previous programs we talked about the 1913, where two terrible things happened. One is the amendment to the U.S. Constitution that for the progressive federal income tax, and the second was the creation of the Federal Reserve. So the following year, when both of those two things become effective, what you find is that within a 15-year period of that time, the United States entered a deadly war that the only benefit was to save J.P. Morgan and bankers, and the two worst recessions in the nation's history are both born out of the United States committing to the federal income tax system and to the creation of the Federal Reserve. It was not a good beginning, and it's amazing that Americans were so apathetic that they did nothing to rid themselves of these two foes. So during FDR's initial years, he was enormously anti-business. We think that Obama is anti-business, and it's true. Well, FDR was at war with business, and he enacted the largest increase in federal tax rates than at any time in U.S. history. This is all well before the United States even began to produce war equipment for World War II. And as a direct result of increasing taxes, he deepened and extended the Great Depression for more than a decade. We read the following on Wikipedia. The recession of 1937 is almost, this is in the midst of that period, is only considered minor when compared to the Great Depression, but it is otherwise the worst recession of the 20th century. Three explanations are offered for the depression, with the depression within a depression. Higher taxes during FDR's administration, tight fiscal policy from the Federal Reserve, and the expansion of the New Deal that increased government spending. This resulted in declining profits for business, which led to a reduction in investment and continued job losses. The contraction of the economy was a staggering 18% on top of the decline that was already being suffered during the Great Depression, and unemployment, which had recovered, dipped to 19%. As I've stated, in 1932, Democrats took control of all three branches of the U.S. government, maintaining a monolithic control for the next 15 years. It was a blow from which America would never recover. During that time, the deficits were $23 billion, $34 billion, $12 billion, $36 billion, $18 billion, $5 billion, $24 billion, $18 billion, and $41 billion between 1932 and 1941, all prior to the war. And so I had read to you a 10-year previous period where we had nothing but surpluses. Now we have nothing but deficits. Taxes were tripled. The rate on the most productive wage earners were tripled. And surpluses were turned into a consistent stream of deficits. Then these deficits skyrocketed in World War II as the annual debt of the nation rose to $144 billion, $371 billion, $365 billion, and $320 billion in the years 1942 through 1945. Under FDR, America became a fascist nation with a de facto dictator. It sacrificed everything, including its constitution, its financial well-being, the lives of its sons and daughters, and its morality, embracing enemies like Stalin and Mao while bombing civilian populations into submission. The tax rate during this tragic period went from 25% in 1931 to 63% for each of the next 4 years. Then it escalated to 79% throughout FDR's second term. Again, all prior to the war, stifling investment, job growth, and economic development. In 1941, the tax rate on the most productive Americans was increased to 81%, and then to 88% in 1942 and 1943. There's a reason that the sharp decline that occurred in 1929 would be unresolved and even deepen in 1937 and continue all the way through the entire decade. FDR's confiscation of the wealth of productive individuals ultimately peaked in 1944 and 1945 at a staggering 94%. What was the incentive?
I've seen the longevity products work for many others, and so I bought a bunch of them, started using them, had a little bit of results, but I wasn't following the regimen every day. But Aaron Dykes.